Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about magnetic resonance imaging, episode 3. And I'm reading a Wikipedia article on it. That's one that, where the information is coming through. But it's one source. The other source is sort of a general knowledge of spectroscopy and quantum mechanics. That's one aspect of it. And possibly another aspect is for you, where you've seen these machines. I think I've seen it in-house. And you may have had an MRI scan. And it's a very large donut, possibly about 3 meters across, with a 1 meter or 80 centimeter hole in the center of it, with an intense magnetic field. And this magnetic field means that you yourself turn into a radio transmitter, and the radio energy is put in you and then pulsed out of you, and it's read off. They read you off, and read off slices of you. So they can change the magnetic field. So it's got to be a perfect value to match the radio signal, and they make that perfect value equal, that perfect solution equal a plane which cuts through you, and then they read off you. And it's how they do it is something which really makes me think and wonder. There's a lot of wonder involved in this, and they read it off. Last episode, I began to talk a little bit about, and I got cut off before I could continue reading, about the magnetic dipole of the proton and how it actually precesses and spins. So I'll get back to that, because there are two time constants. One's the population inversion, so there's two levels. There's the lowest state, where the dipole, the magnet north, is aligned to point to the south pole. So that's the lowest energy. So if you have a bar magnet, two bar magnets, it will want to flip. And given there are two states, two energy levels, so there's not an infinite level of where you can actually push from one level to the other. It's not like a gear stick. It actually appears in from one point to the other. So it's like one of those movies where I think we had even vampires, they show you a little, I think, was it in, I'm trying to think of the vampire movie. It's not Frozen, it's some other, Frozen's a Disney movie, it's some sort of, things where they show people move incredibly quickly. It actually folds inside itself through a dimension that's not really, that we can't experience. It actually plumbs through. It's like a telescope with no eyepiece in it. You can actually, or no lens piece in it. You can actually push it through either way. I was trying to think of something similar to it. It's where it pulls it, like a sock. Sock is probably the simplest example. It has an outside and inside. It actually pulls itself inside out. So it's the north pole of the proton. It gets pushed inside through itself and becomes the north pole, with north and south interchange. And this pulling inside out, again, is insufficient for us to fully understand it. The rotational symmetry of a proton is not 360 degrees, but 720 degrees. Now, even as such, the idea of a proton spinning, it is spinning. It has an angular momentum of h, and the angular momentum changes. Its actual sense of rotation changes. It has to have a handle. It's actually got to grab onto space and actually push itself in and out of space. Just grab onto it and push it through. And it's not rotating as in the sense that something can rotate. So, say if I have an engine or a fan blade, it's a very, very famous story. A Australian golfer walked up to was walking back from an aircraft and walked straight into a an aircraft propeller. He couldn't see it. It was spinning so fast, and it just whipped off his arm. And we always say, "What's?" And his name was Jack Newton. And we have this joke about how much energy does it take to stop an aircraft propeller? And we say half a newton. But like the aircraft propeller, you can actually, it's actually spinning very fast, but you can see it. It's not spinning so fast you can't, the newton's not spinning so fast you can't see it. There is actually no ability to define part of a proton or a neutron with which to put a marking on it to actually observe its spinning. So it's not like a bear spinning or you spinning or something spinning. But you can actually watch it going around. There's actually no physical part of the neutron to observe that it's going. It changes phase and all that type of stuff. So this spinning, now it has angular momentum, but this angular momentum is left over from its creation, how it was created in the universe. And it has a basic, parts of the bane which are pulled in to actually make it have some angular momentum aspects to it, which sort of define as part of the overall universal angular momentum. So angular momentum is a pretty special thing. So if I'm in a spaceship in a dark room in a box and I spin, I can still tell how fast I'm spinning to compare to someone else on Earth, because when I spin, my arms fly out. It's angular momentum. It's a pretty fundamental thing. And the basic unit of angular momentum is H, or Planck's constant, and that actually comes in so many ways. It describes the actual bulk of things, bulk of objects is that pixel size of a universe. It also defines the amount of energy given out, or the amount of momentum transferred in a light pulse. So a photon. Now, let's write. A photon will transport three sorts of things. When I receive a light pulse, I pick up a light pulse, I say, thank you very much, there's so much energy, which is the Planck's constant times the frequency. And then I receive so much kick, kickback, sort of like punch, sort of a flash and a punch. The punch I receive is H on lambda, or lambda's in meters, I think it is. Yeah, it would be in meters. And that's in momentum, so it's just a very tiny amount of momentum. And so, basically, so it's the smallest amount of momentum you can give someone. Someone's car is stuck in the mud somewhere and you want to give it a push, well, you can give it a push. You could send an infrared photon towards them and it will give them a push. But another thing it will do is it will also give them a twist. So you can imagine we have these things where we grab a chubby person, grab a piece of flesh and give it a twist, give them an overall twist. If I don't know what the term for that thing. Not sure, I won't say it's good. Probably not acceptable anymore to say it, but it's a general twist, and twist can be given to an object as in angular momentum. But there is a catch. The twist, the absorption, and all the energy all has to be absorbed. When light is absorbed, photons are quantized. They're not. Their energy is not quantized, their momentum is not quantized, that can be anything, but their angular momentum is quantized. They've always got plus or minus one unit of angular momentum. And so we can tell at this stage that you will radiate when we store these units of angular momentum in your photons. We put them in, store, and over time, we can actually release these photons out. Now, it's something which I find, really hurts my head to think about some of it. And obviously, I'm on rehab, trying to walk in the stuff that I've learned, see if there's stuff that's been wiped out, and go through to here. So, what's happened is that We have, you've got a whole lot of protons in your inner magnetic field, and they will dangle in the direction of the magnetic field. We can actually set them on end and store energy in your photons. So there's one thing that has to be, let's be realistic here. There's no magic happening here. We store energy in you as a short-term battery, and we watch you glow and discharge. We charge you up with RF pulse, and we watch you radiate out. And it's, you know, something which I'm, I'm sure if I really get into it, all the physics will add up to, but we are sure that we can't make use you as a magic experiment to power, light up a city. There's sort of infinite motion, again, the words was gone from my head, something rather motion, a free energy machine. You're not free energy. We put energy into you in an RF pulse, and it's stored in your protons, and then after a while we take it out again, and as we take it out we actually have a bit of a think to see the quality of your batteries in it. So it's a sort of a magnetic spin battery, which is put in. Now the magnet, your magnets in you, which are dangling in the direction of the magnetic field, because they've got a spin, they don't line up with the field perfectly. They've got an angle, kick off angle, and they process around in the circle, and they don't, guess what, they don't radiate energy out in that form. Otherwise we could just get you to stand in a magnet and cook a microwave chicken off it. That type of stuff. Or boil a cup of water. Nothing magic about it. Your protons are moving in a circle. It's just we know that they're moving in a particular circle. They're processing. And what we can do is that we can put RF pulse in. The RF pulse gets absorbed as some of your protons, get pushed against the magnetic field, the north facing the north. That's a higher energy state, and over time they'll pop out, and when they pop out they emit energy. That's the natural thing. So they absorb energy when you put in RF pulse, and over time they'll emit energy. There's nothing too spectacular about that, and they emit energy sort of like basic thermal hiss sort of coming out. However, we can get your protons, little thing in your flesh, to go oi like that by this sequence. And so there's a part of the thing which I don't fully understand. I sort of can visualize but not fully understand. We put in the first RF pulse such that we get 50% upper and 50% lower spin up, spin down, because what happens is that same RF pulse, so the spin up, spin down is upper and lower energy levels, and what happens is that with the Einstein equations which describe an RF pulse coming in, or light coming in and getting absorbed, so it can be absorbed by any one of a number of things. It can be absorbed by dipole transition, electric dipole. This is not happening here. You don't have a charge separation. I'm not getting that electric charge to move inside an atom. It can be a magnetic dipole transition. And such transitions are in space. The simplest magnetic dipole transition is the 21 centimeter radiation of a electron dipole in the field of the very weak field of the proton. So the proton and electrons, they're both charged and they have a magnetic field. So you've got a charge. There's a charge on the electron, but also there's a north and a south pole on the electron. And how that was done was a Sternfeld experiment in the 30s. They had a beam of silver ions. They fired it through a non-uniform magnetic field. And, you know, again, this is my memory. I can't quite remember. There's some aspect for a non-uniform magnetic field which doesn't diagonalize out. I just have to really get... And so that separates for your stream of silver particles. If it's fired into neutral silver particles, shouldn't care about the magnetic field, except they do because they've got one unaligned electrons. And so you can get, in a non-uniform magnetic field, you can get this separation up, positive and sort of north pole ones and south pole ones facing respect to that field. I'm just quantizing it, the two aspects get across here. So what happens here is that it's radiating out rubbish in all directions all the time. And what we do is we say, well, look, we can actually sync things up and sync it so it radiates into our antenna. So all the time it's radiating all over the place, we can actually sync it and tap it such as it's radiating. So there's nothing magic. It doesn't wait around and stop radiating, waiting for, are you ready now? Oh, it's all okay. They're listening now. Let's tell them. It's going, it's decaying all the time. But its decay is, so there's a massive amount of energy put in, and over a minute or so, it just slowly, it slowly dies down, or probably, no, I don't know, a couple of seconds, at least 10 seconds. Because that's the amount of time, so you put in a pulse and it takes this time to go down. I just have to really, really have to think about all this. And, when you put a pulse in, you can arrange it such that it's in harmony. Rather than just one proton, you have two protons, one spin up, one spin down, and they're going hooking around the center. And if they hook around at the same orbiting rate, so, if you're looking from the top there, if you're looking from the top down, same as you're saying above them, you'll see one with a little north towards you and one with a little south towards you, and that little north, that pole is orbiting like a clock face. Now imagine they're going around and the clocks are in synchrony going around. If they're in synchrony, they can, and they radiate out, they will produce something which is picked up by the antenna, which is read by the computer. Now, they're not radiating out all the time. There's no energy system. The only energy they have is popping out. They have to go from energy level to low energy. The only way that a photon gets out of the bizo is a transition from the high energy level to the low energy level. Okay, that means that you have bought that amount of energy, and that amount of energy goes into the magnetic field, or the electromagnetic field around the outside. It comes out again. So there's an energy conservation. So essentially, in terms of energy conservation, the energy is put into your flesh, stored there for a while, and comes out. And the only difference is, at the end of the day, you are at lower energy, and the field and the apparatus at slightly higher energy is picked it up. So that exchange which goes through it. So there's two time constants. There's the overall time constant, the rate of producing radiation, which is T2, so T1, and the rate of decohering. So it's putting out the T1s all the time. T2 is those little protons on average pointing at to the clock, so to speak. So imagine you're looking on top of it and it's spinning anti-clockwise. So you're looking at the top down, your eye is in the direction the magnetic field line is coming out of the patch, right through your eye, the center of your eye, and you're looking down, you will see a one where the north is showing its north, the other one, which has been pulled inside out, the south is showing to you, and they will they will process around the orbit. So you can't see them spin. No one can see them spin. So spin is a concept, but it's not. It's got a physical analog, which is not useful to us. But we see it go across, and we can pick it up if I have a transition such that they're at 5 seconds. They're at, I suppose, 11 o'clock, 10 seconds, 10 o'clock. Across, going across, and that's, as they move out, as the little pairs move out, the overall effect cancels out. So as they decohere in pairs, and so there's a rate at which these move out of synchrony with each other. This is from so any two protons almost the same molecule. They'll be sweet. They're not going to get much effect. But if they're apart or in a different region, they'll decohere. And so that coherence of gyration is T2. Now there's a T. We'll go through and read it here. So this is where we read this article here, and it's 21 minutes in, and I'll start reading from here. So this is on page whatever it is. It's not number T. It's T1 and T2. So there are, unfortunately, they overuse T too much. They use a T for the proton, what's going on with the proton, and T for the machine. So they have a time for repeating repulse. This is where they charge you up. And a TE for the echo pulse, the time when they say, all right, photons, cohere. I command you to cohere. Tap, tap, the conductors, and I listened. You can hear the bow bird behind me. So it's overuse of the word T. So the T1, T2 refers to the decay rate of these spinning protons. Each tissue returns its equilibrium state after excitation by an independent relaxation process of T1 spin lattice, that is, magnetization in the same direction of the static magnetic field. So each little lump of tissue will decay at a certain rate, a T1 rate. It will, so you've flipped 50% of the magnets in you, and it will flip back naturally depending on the how it's coupled. And T2, which is spin, transverse to the static magnetic field. So this one is sort of a composite idea of these two things spinning together. They've got to spin at the same rate. So if they get, 90 degrees out of phase, they disappear. If they get pointed out of phase, it's not there. I think that would be quite interesting to think about. To create a T1 weighted image, magnetization is allowed to recover before measuring the MR signal by changing the repetition time. So the magnetism is allowed to recover. So the magnetization of the thing is allowed to go down to almost completely in the lower state. Okay. By changing the repetition time, TR. See, they've overused the letter T, TR. This image is weighted, is useful assessing cerebral cortex, identifying fatty tissue, characterizing focal liver lesion, and in general for obtaining morphological information as well as post-contrast imaging. Whatever the heck does it mean? So, you've got two things. That's the decay rate of it. But also you've got the photon intensity. So I don't understand why they haven't said that. But this is a Wikipedia article. So there's the proton density, the actual intensity, and the rate at which it decays. To create a T2 weighted image, this is now seeing that they actually spin at the same rate. So So what happens is they're wobbling, but if one's got a bit more friction on it, so to speak, or it's coupled, it will spin at a slightly different rate. I'm going to pick it out. Magnetization is allowed to decay before measuring the MR signal by changing the echo time TE. This image weighting is useful in edema and inflammation, relieving mat lesions and assessing zonal anatomy in the prostate and uterus. Okay, so TE, okay, so they have a graph here called INTENZITA strength. Oh, initial, I don't know what strength unit, and TR, they have TR and TE, so I don't quite understand what they mean. The effects of TR and TE on the signal, and they have a graph there which I've seen many, many times, but I don't quite understand. So if you increase the TR, so TR is the gap between signals, so if you get the TR, you'll see certain signals which have got a greater T1 decay more, and then if you've got a greater time between TE, you'll get you'll see things which signals which have a strong T2 signal. Let's read it here. The standard display of MRI images is to represent fluid characteristics in black and white images where different tissues turn without the solid. Okay, now, so there's two signal images. Here they go. Examples of T1 weighted, T2 weighted, and PD weighted MRIs images. So what they do have here is they've got three pictures of the brain, and my godfather, if that is true, I just want to look at it whether it looks dramatically different. There must be a different hearts. So PD stands for proton density. Okay, and that's what I tried to say before, and in this article they haven't mentioned proton density, so let you poor souls try and understand why there are three images here. So I assume this is the same patient, and looking through, my issue here is that I think he's got a different slice. I think yeah, look, I have to say these are different. So depending on proton density is just like if you're going to cut it open, that would how watery it would look. And then you've got T1, which interrogates the actual tissue itself and the surrounding tissue. Let's read it across here. So the signal is white. A high signal on a T1 weighted one, so it sees a fat subacute hemorrhage, melanin, protein-rich fluid, slowly flowing fluid, blood, paramagnetic substances such as gallium, manganese, and copper. Okay, now just let's stop there for the moment. A paramagnetic substance is there's diamagnetic. So paramagnetic is that it it is attracted to the magnetic field. I don't think that this is sort of the most important aspect to it. It's the spin orientation. So, gondolin, manganese. Gondolin is in the rare earths in that F block, and it's the one after Europium. Okay, and so it's just in the middle there. It's got eight unpaired electrons, so it's massive. Manganese is, again, next to iron. So it's similarly in the center, and it's got a lot of unpaired electrons. Okay. Cortical pseudolamellar necrosis. Whatever that means, it means something, it looks like it's something dead. Okay. So they'll appear white. And so, you see the picture of the brain there, and, basically it just shows up the bone as far as I can see. Now, for T2, which will seem bright, so what, it will see more water content, as in edema, tumor, infraction, inflammation, and infection, extracellularly located, methaglobin in subacute hemorrhage, whatever does that mean? I don't quite understand that. Okay, T1, grey matter is darker than white matter. And the other one, T2, white matter is darker than grey matter. So, okay. So, they're the same images, but you will be able to see white and grey matter due to the amount of fat. So I would assume, I really wouldn't make any assumptions, don't ask me. I really don't understand whether white matter has more or less fat. But one, T1, and T2 will look fat. I can actually go back and I believe T1 is for fat. For low colour, and this is something which I think is a bit wrong here. A low signal is for bone, urine, CFS, air, more, obviously, hopefully, air is for low, both things. So T2 doesn't see as much fat. As low proton density, such as calcification and fibrosis. Paramagnetic materials such as deoxyhemoglobin, insular, iron, ferulin, melanin, protein-rich fluid. Okay, so there's two different types of things. So you get three images out. I don't understand why they haven't explained it. You've got proton density, which is the intensity of image. You've got, then you divide the proton density, see how much that proton density fades. It gives you the T1, image, or you can actually look at the decay rate for after the strength of the echo. Okay, now here's usage by organelle system. Okay, for some reason we've left the physics of it, and the physics is quite important. MRI has a wide range of applications in medical diagnosis. More than 25,000 scanners are estimated to be used worldwide. That is just astonishing. I'd have to say there's probably about 50 in Sydney, or no, 20 in Sydney. MRI affects diagnosis and treatments in many specialties, although the effect on improved health outcomes is uncertain. I think it's no doubt for me. MRI is an investigation of choice in preoperative staging of rectal and prostate cancer, and has a role in the diagnosis, staging, and follow-up of other tumours. Especially when you add MRI and the ultrasonic burning. Okay, neuroimaging. MRI to investigate tool of choice for neurological scans. It's better resolution than CT and offers a better visualization of the posterior cranial fossa containing the brainstem and cerebellum. The contrast between grey and white matter makes MRI the best choice for many conditions of the central nervous system, including demyelinating diseases, dementia, cerebrovascular disease, infectious disease, Alzheimer's disease, and epilepsy. Many images are taken milliseconds apart that shows how the brain responds to different stimuli, enabling researchers to study both functional and structural brain abnormalities and physiological disorders. MRI is also used in a guided stereotactic surgery, a radiosurgery for treatment of intracranial tumours, intravenous malformations, and other surgically treatable conditions using a device known as the N-localizer. Well, I want you to understand, I think that's what they're talking about. You can actually get the MRI and the radar happening. Okay, cardiovascular, that's your brain. Cardio MRI is complementary to other imaging techniques which it uses, such as endocardiography, cardiac CT, nuclear medicine. This application includes assessment of mitochondrial ischemia, mitocardial, so that ischemia means reduced blood, and viability, cardiomyopathies, microcarditis, and iron overload, vascular disease, and congenital heart disease. I think, in general, it's not a patch on the stuff, the sheer amazing resolution you can get out of a CT scan. Musculoskeletal, this is other body bits. Application in musculoskeletal includes spinal imaging assessment, joint disease, and soft tissue tumours. Yeah. Things which don't have good x-ray contrast. Liver and gastrointestinal. Hepatobiliary MR is used to detect lesions in the liver, pancreas, bile ducts. Focal or diffuse orders of the liver may be evaluated using diffusion weighting, opposed phase imaging, and dynamic contrast enhancement techniques. Extracellular contrast agents are used widely in the liver MRI, and newer hepatobiliary contrast agents also provide opportunity to perform functional biliary imaging. Anatomical imaging of the bile ducts is achieved using heavy T2 weighted sequence intermagnetic resonance cholangiopancreatic echography, MRCP. Functional imaging of the pancreas is performed following administration of secretin, whatever that is. MR enterography provides non-invasive assessment of inflammatory bowel disease and small bowel tumours. MR chronography may play a role in the detection of large polyps in patients at increased risk of colorectal cancer. Okay. It's coming. I just think, you know, colonoscopy takes such a lot of prep to get it right. Angiography. Magnetic resonance angiography, MRA, generates pictures of the arteries to evaluate them for stenosis, abnormal narrowing, and aneurysm, vessel walls, dilation, and risk of rupture. MRA is often used to evaluate arteries in the neck and brain, and thoracic abnormal aorta and renal arteries and legs, called runoff. A variety of techniques can be used to generate the picture by the administration of paramagnetic agent gadolinium, or using a technique using a flow-related Hansen, e.g. 2D and 3D time-related things. So, essentially, you wait long enough and the magnetized blood flows out of the region. So it just goes off. It's pretty amazing what they can do. Where the most of the signal of the image is due to the blood that has recently moved into the plane. Isn't that amazing? So you beat it up and then you decide you power up one thing and then you catch it a bit later on. Techniques involving phase accumulation, versus phase contrast accumulation, and geography can be used to generate flow velocity maps easily and accurately. Magnetic resonance venography, MRV, is a similar procedure that uses to image veins. In this method, the tissue is now excited inferiorly, of the blood is gathered in the plane immediately superior to the excitation plane. Thus imaging venous blood has recently moved from the excited plane. Pretty much the same type of stuff. So you excite on one plane and then just move a little bit further up. Contrast agents. MRI for imaging anatomical structures of blood flow do not require contrast agents, as varying properties of the tissues and blood provide natural contrast. However, for more specific types of imaging, extraneous contrast agents may be given intravenously, orally, or interarticularly, in the arteries. The most common used intravenous contact is based on chelates of gadolinium. So I really like that rare earth. Chelates means chemical cages, so it's made chemically active, biologically active. So normally if I feed you a lump of metal, it just goes through you. If you coat it in biological stuff, it will go through you. In general, these agents have proved safer than iodinated contrast agents used in X-ray radiography or CT. So, in general, you have to have something with a very heavy nucleus, lots of inner electrons. Anaphylactoid reactions are rare, occurring in approximately 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 3,000. Of particular interest is the low incidence of nephrotoxicity compared with iodinated agents. When given at usual doses, these may contrast enhancement with MRI scanning, an option for patients with renal impairment who would otherwise not be able to undergo contrast enhanced CT. Yeah, so I've had to have a few CT scans before they actually do the heart. And one time they injected the dye into my muscle. Nurse rushed out and then squeezed my arm and squirted me with my contrast agent. Although gadolinium agents have proved useful for patients with renal impairment, in patients with severe renal failure requiring dialysis are at risk of a rare but serious illness, nephrogenic system fibrosis, which is linked to the use of certain gadolinium-containing agents. So the rings of nephron, so that's what they mean here, which is these very fine plumbing in the kidney, sort of this double back plumbing. I've got to see if I can remember it. The most frequently linked is galdoamide. Other agents linked too, although the causal link has not been definitely established. The current guidelines in the United States are that dialysis patients should only receive gadolinium agents where essential, and the dialysis should be performed as soon as possible after the scan to remove from the body promptly. In Europe, where more gadolinium-containing agents are available, a classification of agents according to potential risk has been released. Recently, a new contrast agent called galdoacetate, brand name Evost and Primvost EU, was approved for diagnostic use. This is a theoretical benefit of a dual excretion path, whatever that means. MRI sequences. MRI sequence is a particular setting of radio frequency pulses and gradients resulting in a particular image appearance. The T1 and T2 weighting can also be described by MRI sequence. So they've got a sequence and they've got this table here. Now, this table does not include uncommon and experimental sequences, so this is the main thing. So these are the brands of MRI. You go in for MRI, you get these various brands. Okay. Spin echo sequence, and this is just to die for. It's so lovely. So spin echo is, you fire it up, and you put a echo pulse in, which basically inverts all the pulses, and actually the fast one, which is racing in front of the others, spins, is actually set back to be slower because it's been pushed inside out. So it's actually pulled. A lot of people say it's a 180 degree inversion. It's actually an inversion. It's actually, you rip the actual spin through its own guts. And therefore, where it was going fast, it's now still going fast, but further behind, so it catches up. And when the spins, all the spins catch up, you get this echo pulse. Now, T1, a spin echo, and you can have these three things, and I only tell you this now. We can have T1 weighted, T2 weighted, and proton density. So T1, the physics of it measures the spin lattice relaxation by using its short repetition rate and echo time. So it's looking at reason you want a short repetition rate is so you can get a lot in. So T1 you can measure a lot, and echo time so you do, and you're interested in just the size of it. So you hit it quickly, and then you let it, and then a short echo time, you don't really worry how much they're dephasing. So the T2 is the echo time, is the dephasing. Many clinical distinctions. Lower signal for more water content, as in edema, tumor, infraction, inflammation, infection, hyperacute chronic hemorrhage. High signal for fat. High signal for paramagnetic substances. So, I suppose, I don't know what that actually means. T2 weighted. So this is measuring the spin relaxation using a long TR and TE times. So, high signals for more water content. Low signals for fat, because, fat decoheres it because the spins are in a different environment. Low signals for paramagnetic substances, i.e. that goes sound foundation comparison for other sequences. So T2 is just to tune it up. And so basically you get the fluid in between. Now, proton density weighted. Long TR to reduce T1 and short TE to minimize T2 decoherence. So it just gives you the proton density. High signal from meniscus tears pinched. Okay, so that's the proton density. Now gradient echo. What the heck is gradient echo? Maintenance of a steady residual transverse magnetization over successive cycles. So, I really don't know what gradient is, Jerry. And T1, T2, or T2 star. Perfect excitation, refocus GRE with small flip angles. So what GRE is, I don't understand. We'll have to get back into inversion recovery thing, STIR. So it's called, the sequence is high tau investigation. So, so gradient is steady state free precession. So it's called an SS. FP signal. So let's read through these. The abbreviations can have T1, T2, PD, SSFP, which is gradient echo, or T star, T2 star, which is straight after the just looking at it decay straight from the signal. Low signal from hemosiderin deposits, pictured, and hemorrhages. Oh, yeah. I wish I understood this. Inversion recovering. So now let's go into it. This page alone, in spin echo, you can have T1, T2, or proton density, gradient echo. What does that mean? I really wish I understood how that works. Inversion recovering. STIR, short tau inversion. recovery. By setting the inversion time where the signal of fat is zero. So there is something that you can actually set your inversion time, which is your echo time, such that fat doesn't give a signal. How does that work? I don't understand. Flare. Fluid attenuated inversion recovery. Fluid suppression by setting inversion time that nulls the fluid. So there's something you can do with the inversion time. So inversion time is the time for the echo. I don't quite understand it. DIR, simultaneous suppression of cerebrospinal fluid and white matter by two inversion times. That's just, oh my god. High signal of multiple sclerosis plaques pictured. Wow. Oh gosh, that's just insane. Whoa. So, yeah. So, flare is, I'm interested in, is fluid suppression by setting inversion time that nulls the fluid. So, okay. Diffusion weighted, DWI. And you've got, so there's three, inversion recovery. So this is insanely complicated. And so you've got stare, flare, and double inversion recovery. So that's pretty amazing. Okay, now diffusion weighted. You can have conventional apparent diffusion coefficient and diffusion tensor. Oh god, the amount of physics in this. Now the physics is conventional diffusion weight measures the Brownian motion of water molecules. Wow, there's enough physics in this to really hurt you. You need a PhD to understand this. High signal within minutes of cerebral infarction. Wow. Apparent diffusion coefficient. Okay, reduce T2 weighting by taking multiple conventional DIW images with different DIW weighting and changes corresponds to diffusion. Low signal minutes after cerebral infraction. So you can see if your head is just absolutely cracked up. Okay, diffusion tensor. Mainly tactography pictured by overall greater Brownian motion of water molecules in the direction of the nerve fibers. You can actually see evaluating white matter deformation by tumors. Reduced fractional anisotropy may indicate dementia. Oh, diffusion tensor. Wow. That's incredible. This diffusion weighted, perfusion weighted. How are you going to understand this one? Dynamic susceptibility contrast. Gondola contrast is injected and rapid repeated imaging generally. Cerebral infraction, infected core, penumbra have decreased perfusion. Generally, gradient echo, T2 weighted, quantifies susceptibility induced signal loss. My god. Dynamic contrast enhanced. So this is with contrast. Measuring shortening of spin lattice relaxation induced by gondolin contrast bolus. Arterial spin labouring. Magnetic labouring of arterial blood below the imaging slab which subsequently enters the region of interest. Does not need gondolin contrast. So this is what you put in. Functional MRI, which is okay. Which is called blood oxygen level dependent imaging, BOLD. Changes in oxygen saturation dependent on magnetism of hemoglobin reflects the activity. Hardly active brain areas before surgery. I just... Okay. So, functional... So, there's so much to understand. I cannot believe it's so complicated. Magnetic resonance angiography, MRA, venography, and venography, time of flight, and measures blood entering the image area is not yet magnetically saturated, giving a much higher signal when using short echo time and flow compensation. Gee, there's so much to understand. That phase contrast magnetic resonant imaging, PCRMA. Two gradients of equal magnitude but opposite directions are used to encode the phase shift, which is proportional to... Gosh. The velocity of spins. This is just insane. Okay, susceptibility weighted SWI, sensitive for blood and calcium that fully flow compensated long echo gradient called echo GRE pulse sequence to exploit magnetic susceptibility between different tissues. Detecting small amounts of hemorrhage, diffuse injury, pigment or calcium. Wow. There is so much here to go through. I'll have to read another book. So let's try and get it. There's spin echo. There's nulled things, double nulled things, gradient echoes, susceptibility. It just goes on. I can't even get my mind around it. You really need a chart, some sort of chart to do it. Other specialized configurations, if that's not enough. Magnetic resonance spectroscopy. Magnetic resonance spectroscopy is used to measure different metabolites in the body tissues. In MR signals, produces a spectrum of resonances that responds to different molecular arrangements of the isotope being excited. This instrument is used to diagnose certain metabolic disorders, especially affecting the brain, and provide information about tumor metabolism. Magnetic resonance spectroscopy imaging, MRSI, combines both spectroscopic and imaging methods to produce spatially localized spectra within a sample of the patient. The spatial resolution is much lower, limited by available signal-to-noise ratios, but the spectra of each voxel contains information about many metabolites. Because the available signal is used to encode spatial and spectral information, MRSI requires high signal-to-noise achieved only with a high field strength of 3 teslas and above. The high procurement and maintenance cost of MRI with extremely high field strengths inhibit their popularity. However, recent compressed sensing based on software algorithms, SAMV, has been proposed to achieve super resolution without requiring high magnetic fields. Okay. So this is pretty amazing stuff. This is so much to think about. So these high magnetic fields can give you just incredibly information. This is almost too much. This is too much information. Within 10 years, we've done all this stuff. I can't. There's just so much information. And I just, how does the gradient echo work? I've got to really work this out. Real-time MRI refers to continuous imaging of moving objects such as the heart in real-time. One of the many different strategies developed since the early 2000s is based on flash MRI, the iterative reconstruction. This gives temporal resolutions of 20 to 30 milliseconds for images within plane resolution of 1.5 to 2 millimeters. This method is likely to add important information on diseases of the heart and joints. In many cases, may make MRI examinations easier and comfortable for patients. That really hurts to even think about that. That's just so great. So they can, by tweaking it, get some really high rates. The lack of harmful effects on the patients and the operator make MRI well suited for interventional radiology, where images produced by MRI scanners discard minimally invasive procedures such as the use of non-ferromagnetic instruments. Obviously, you don't want a scalpel which gets ripped out of your hand. A specialized growing subset of interventional MRI is interoperative MRI, which the MRI is used in surgery. Some specialized MRI systems allow imaging concurrent with surgical procedures. More typical, surgery procedure is temporarily interrupted, so the MRI can assess the success of the procedure and guide subsequent surgical works. Oh, this is it. This is something we should come across. Magnetic resonance guided focused ultrasound. In guided therapy, high intensity focused ultrasound, high few beams are focused on the tissue. They are controlled using MRI thermal imaging. Due to the high energy of the focus, the temperature rises above 65 degrees or 100, which is completely destroys the tissue. This technology can achieve precise ablation of disease tissues. MRI imaging provides three-dimensional view of the target tissue, allowing for precise focusing of the ultrasound energy. The MRI imaging provides qualitative real-time thermal imaging of the treated area. This allows the physician to ensure the temperature generated during each cycle is sufficient to cause thermal ablation with the desired tissue, and if not, to adapt parameters to the effective tissue treatment. Multinuclear imaging. Hydrogen has been the most frequently imaged nucleus of MRI because of its presence in biological tissues in great abundance, and because of the high gyromagnetic ratio gives a strong signal. However, any nucleus with a net nuclear spin could be predominantly imaged with MRI. Such nucleus are helium-3, bugger if you got that one, lithium-7, no, carbon-13, you do have that one, fluorine-19, well, do you want fluorine-19? I think that's radioactive. Fluorine-19 is radioactive. Oxygen-17, yes, sodium-23, phosphorus-31, yes, xenon-129 if you happen to be that. Oh, yes, suppose you can infuse that. Sodium-23 and phosphorus-31 are naturally abundant in the body, so can be used directly. Gaseous isotopes of helium and xenon-129 must be hyperpolarized and then inhaled by the nuclear density is too low to yield useful signal under normal conditions. Oxygen-17 and fluorine-19 can be administered in sufficient quantities in liquid form. Oh yeah, water. And hyperpolarization is not necessary. I don't want to say polarization. Using helium and xenon has the advantage of reduced background noise and therefore increased contrast to the image itself, because the elements are not normally present in biological tissues. Yeah, I'm not happy with that one. Moreover, the nucleus of an atom that has a net nuclear spin and is bonded to a hydrogen atom could potentially be imaged via heteronuclear magnetic transfer that would image the high gyromagnetic ratio hydrogen nucleus instead of the low gyromagnetic ratio nucleus that is bonded to the hydrogen atom. In principle, heteronuclear magnetization transfer MRI could be used to detect the presence and absence of specific chemical bonds. Multinuclear imaging is primarily a research technique at present. However, potential applications include functional imaging of organs formerly seen in H1 MRI, e.g. the lungs and bones. Alternate contrast organs. Why not just leave it in the research lab, my friend? Inhaled hyperpolarized, what? Helium-3 can be used to image the distribution of air spaces within the lungs. Injectable solutions of carbon-13 or stabilized bubbles of hyperpolarized. I've got to work out what hyperpolarized. I've never heard of this word. What is hyperpolarized? Xenon-139. Do you think it's already put in a magnetic field before it's given there? Are studied as contrast agents in angiographic and perfusion imaging. Phosphorus 31 can potentially provide information of on bone. density and structure, as well as functional imaging of the brain. Multinuclear imaging holds the potential to chart distribution of lithium in the brain. This element is finding use as an important drug for those with... I feel this is really poor. Molecular imaging of MRI. MRI has the advantage of having high spatial resolution and are very adept at morphological imaging and functional imaging. MRI does have several disadvantages though. Firstly, MRI has a sensitivity of around 10^3 moles per litre to 10^5 moles per litre, which is compared to other types of imaging is very limiting. This problem stems from the fact that the population difference between nuclear spin states is very small at room temperature. For example, at 1.5 Tesla, a typical field strength for clinical MRI, the difference between high and low energy states is approximately 9 molecules per 200 million. So 2 million. Improvements to increase the MRI sensitivity include increasing the field strength and hyperpolarization via optical pumping or dynamic nuclear polarization. There is a variety of signal amplification scenes based on chemical exchange to increase sensitivity. So this gives you an idea that this MRI is just scratching the surface. And imagine if you get high fields in there. To achieve molecular imaging of disease biomarkers using MRI, the MRI contrast agents with high specificity and highly relaxed sensitivity are requests. Today, many studies have devoted to developing targeted MRI contrast agents to achieve molecular imaging by MRI. Commonly, peptides, antibodies, and small ligands and small protein domains, such as HeA2 affibodies, have been applied to achieve targeting. To enhance the sensitivity of contrast agents, these targeting modalities are usually linked to high payload MRI contrast agents or MRI contrast agents with high relaxivities. Not relaxivities is, my friend. A new class of gene targeting MRI contrast agents, CA, have been introduced to show gene action of unique mRNA and genome transcription factor proteins. This new CA can trace cells with unique mRNA, messenger RNA, and microRNA and viruses. Tissues respond to inflammation in living brains. The MR reports change in the gene expression and positive correlation to the TAC-MAN analysis in optical electron microscopy. So this is an important point here. So we're going to finish this off here. We're going to get onto the economics of it. We have really not even explained. This article's got nowhere to explain the echo, the gradient, and the fusion rates, and the fact that we've got about 20 different MRI techniques. Thanks a lot for listening. We're going to finish reading this, which is the economics of it, and the understanding that we need a high field units. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.